it's just very sad and disappointing that people would feel the need to do that and want to do that to a school district.
A former Anchorage School District employee is accused of embezzling activity funds. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, remembering the volcanic eruption that buried Kodiak 100 years ago today.
The ash fall was heavy, it collapsed roofs. There were avalanches of ash off the hill slopes. People's lives were pretty devastated by this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
House Republicans are introducing a bill that would force the Secretary of the Interior to hold an annual lease sale for oil and gas drilling in the National Petroleum Reserve. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it's part of a politically tinged energy package.
The bill passed out of committee last year, but it resurfaced Wednesday as part of a collection of bills designed to promote both energy independence and job growth. The act would force the Secretary of the Interior to approve projects within 60 days. It also authorizes the Secretaries of Interior and Transportation to give the go-ahead for any infrastructure project necessary for a drilling operation. That includes building roads or pipelines connecting the reserve to existing ones on the North Slope. It comes along with several other energy provisions, including one that would conduct auctions for drilling leases online. If they make it to the floor for a vote, the bills would likely pass the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. And with gas prices sure to be a campaign theme, there's a political motivation to moving it quickly. For anything to become law, though, it would need to pass the Senate, where there are no accompanying bills. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
A former Anchorage School District Student Activities Secretary has been charged with embezzling more than $100,000 from East High School. 44-year-old Gail White has been charged with first-degree theft, scheme to defraud, and falsifying business records. APD spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says she was working for the school district between 2006 and 2009.
Basically, these thefts occurred when she didn't deposit funds that she was receiving for student activities and things like that.
Parker says the money was not missed because the school district's accounting system at the time did not require the scrutiny that it does now. Parker says White was charged last year with embezzling about $5,000 from Chugiak High School. Police say she pleaded guilty last year in a plea deal with prosecutors. In the most recent case, White has been charged but is currently not in prison. Anchorage School District spokeswoman Heidi Embley says school officials found evidence of embezzlement in the spring of last year.
When we had first issued information about it, we had terminated four employees, including the one in this particular case, for embezzling money from the district. And it's just very sad and disappointing that people would feel the need to do that and want to do that to a school district.
ASD made changes in its accounting procedures last year after White's thefts at Chugiak High came to light. The earlier thefts at East High School were discovered after an audit that followed the Chugiak thefts.
Not only did we track back previous school locations where those employees worked at, we also looked at all of our schools as a whole to see if there was any sort of embezzlement happening at other schools as well. But in this particular case with Gail White, we tracked her previous employment at East High, where she had worked before Chugiak High, and that's when we started uncovering criminal activity there as well.
In the 2011 embezzlement case, another Chugiak High employee, Brenda Burge, was accused of stealing nearly $75,000 from Anchorage School District. Two other ASD employees were terminated last year at West High School and at O'Malley Elementary for similar crimes. Justice Dana Fabe is preparing for her third term as Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. She was recently voted into the position by her colleagues on the bench. She says she's thrilled about the appointment. and says she'll make it a priority to strengthen the relationship between state courts and tribal courts.
We've actually already been discussing the possibility of doing a joint training with tribal court judges where we can learn from each other. It will not be an effort for the state judges to teach the tribal court judges. It will be an effort for us to learn from each other and how we do address the same problems differently and in what ways we can take common knowledge and apply it. We're looking at the possibility of, within the next year or so, doing a judge's training with tribal court judges and state court judges on some alternative dispute resolution processes, including circle sentencing and other alternative dispute resolution methods that are used in some of the villages, to see how judges could, in the state court, could incorporate some of those principles into our cases. But this is a real focus of mine. I think it's tremendously important. We have wonderful tribal judges working throughout our state, and we can learn a lot from them.
There are extremely high and disproportionate numbers of Native people, especially young Native men, in jail in Alaska. How can the court system work, and what is being done currently to ensure there's a proper application of justice for all people in the state?
It's something we're all concerned about. I think the recidivism rates in our state are high, and that is one of the ways we have worked, I think, quite successfully in partnership with the executive branch and the legislature to look for ways to reduce recidivism. So that the courtroom doesn't create a revolving door where when people are out of prison, they reoffend and come right back in.
Chief Justice Carpinetti is highly critical of mandatory sentencing, presumptive sentencing. What are your thoughts on this, and does this make the job of a judge more difficult?
Well, I think the Chief Justice really... in his State of the Judiciary address, focused on this issue. And I'm not sure I would characterize his view as highly critical. I think what he's saying is we need to examine the process that was of mandatory sentencing that was established back in 1980 to look to see, you know, where it's working and where it may be working against the purpose of protecting the public and preventing recidivism. So I think he is a critical thinker. It is one of the things that makes him such a wonderful colleague. And I think what he's saying is we need to be constantly reexamining our justice system to see how can we make it better and is it working as well as it can.
What have you observed during your tenure in terms of women in judicial positions? Morgan Christen was just appointed as the first woman to the Ninth Circuit.
Really?
How important is it to have women in these positions?
Well, I think diversity on the bench, both gender diversity and diversity, racial diversity, are incredibly, and really just diversity of experience, are incredibly important on the bench. I think people come to court and their confidence in the court system and our justice system is enhanced if they see a bench that reflects the diversity of the community appearing before that bench. And one of the things we've done from the court's perspective is to encourage young people of color, and in particular, young Alaska Native students, to consider law as a career. I think it would be really great not only to have more women on the bench, but more Alaska Natives on the bench, more African Americans on the bench, more Hispanic judges, and really to have our bench reflect the incredible and rich diversity of our community.
Dana Fabe is a justice on the Alaska Supreme Court. She starts her third term as Chief Justice on July 1st. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, chronic inebriates in Fairbanks have a new option for housing.
Just in the 3 weeks we've been in operation, we've seen just very good results. Reduction in drinking. It's been very heartwarming.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents meets in Anchorage tomorrow and Friday. The agenda includes acceptance of the fiscal 2013 budget. The $925 million spending plan is up 4% over the current year's budget. UA spokeswoman Kate Wadham says the $363.7 million operating component includes increased support from the state legislature for Regents priority programs.
The honors programs and initiatives to improve graduation rates. We have programs for high-demand jobs in engineering, health, teacher education, and workforce development.
The capital budget contains $37 million from the state for deferred maintenance and over $100 million for new engineering buildings on the Fairbanks and Anchorage campuses. The capital budget also contains millions for ocean acidification, unmanned aerial vehicle, and other research programs. Regents take public testimony tomorrow at 10 a.m. and again Friday at 9 a.m. at the University of Alaska Anchorage. It looks like commercial fishermen in the Bering Sea may take the snow crab quota after all. The fleet has been hampered for months with record-setting ice closing off fishing grounds and damaging gear. But faster fishing brings a whole new set of problems. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that a good chunk of the fleet has been busted for poor fishing practices.
The crab fleet is suffering from a bit of female trouble. Last week, five fishing vessels were cited for possessing female snow crab. That's an unusual number of violations for a fishery with only about 40 boats currently registered, says Sergeant Robin Morissette with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. Three citations were issued on May 29th, and two more were given on May 31st. Morissette adds that the take of female crab can lead to trouble for the fishery down the road.
Because they're females, they've got a lot of eggs on them. You know, those are the breeders. Those need to go back to the bottom.
According to Morissette, the fishing vessels Bulldog, Western Mariner, Aleutian Mariner, Bering Star, and Kona Kai all received write-ups. If convicted, the fishermen cited could face a minimum fine of $3,000 with a maximum of $10,000 for repeat offenders. Morissette recommends that fishermen show caution while sorting out the males from the females. If the females are identified shortly after being caught, they can be thrown back into the water with a high chance of survival. But if females are brought back to shore, they're considered dead loss. Possession of even just one female is a criminal offense. But sloppy sorting may be just one reason for the large number of female crab takes. There could be a biological component, too. Heather Fitch, a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, explains.
We are getting into the time of year that they probably are starting to mate. And, you know, it could be that that's what's occurring, and then you would see more females with the males. Given that, you know, if you get a lot of females coming up with the males, it is very difficult to sort through because the females are actually really little compared to the males.
Fish and Game will continue to monitor the situation through the June 15th closure date. While the department has the authority to shut down the season if female crab possession threatens to damage the fishery, Fish and Game is currently recommending that fishermen use extra care when sorting their product and that they try to avoid fishing grounds where large numbers of females are being caught. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Southeast Alaska's largest Native cultural gathering is set for this week in the capital city. 55 dance groups from Alaska, Canada, and the Lower 48 will take the stage during the three-day event. It's expanded from one hall to a half dozen venues around downtown Anchorage. downtown Juneau and includes a native artist market, food contests, films, lectures, and demonstrations. A University of Pennsylvania expert will also be there to collect DNA samples. He's hoping the genetic testing effort could provide more information about the connections Tlingits and Haidas have with other tribal groups. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The effort is part of a larger project analyzing the genetics of indigenous North American groups. Principal investigator Theodore Schur says it could ultimately map out human migration routes as well as link tribes.
So we're slowly being able to put together, use the data to both see the sort of the deeper history questions, the connections between communities here with those across all of North America on a broader, deeper scale, but also some of these more regional or even tribally based questions, which I think are already understood or being examined through linguistic studies, historical studies, and also oral histories and the work done by the tribes themselves.
Schur will be at Juneau's Centennial Hall during Celebration 2012, which runs Thursday through Saturday. He's working with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which organizes the event. No one is required to participate. Those interested will have the insides of their cheek swab to provide DNA samples. Those will be analyzed, and what's learned will be shared with a volunteer. The information will also contribute to the larger research project. A similar genetic testing effort was conducted 4 years ago by Washington State University. Schur says this project will examine additional elements.
We are taking, I think, the same approach as the earlier study, although analyzing perhaps a number of more markers on for the maternal lineages and the paternal lineages.
DNA samples have already been collected in Yakutat and Heidelberg. The effort at Celebration will reach people from many other communities. Schur hopes to expand the project to other villages, but he's collecting more than cheek swabs.
Ultimately, DNA evidence will tell you a lot about genetic lineages, but why people bear certain genetic lineages has to have some sort of context for interpreting that.
Those providing DNA samples will also be interviewed about their genealogy. Schur says that and other information will allow for a higher level of analysis.
It makes a big difference to have genealogical evidence, oral history information, the archaeology, and so forth, because that tells us something about the context in which people have come to live in a place for a long time, who they've come into contact with, how far and wide they might have dispersed, and because of either environmental, glaciers or volcanoes or things of this sort. And how, in fact, the diversity we see in certain places may be linked to the languages they speak.
Results should be available this year. Schur says volunteers will find out about their individual data before group information is made public. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A new housing program for chronic inebriates in Fairbanks is slowly getting up to speed. The Tanana Chiefs Conference runs the 47-room facility out of a renovated hotel on South Cushman Street. TCC has been working toward bringing in the first tenants since December. Program Director Shirley Lee says 7 people were living in the apartments as of last week.
Some of our kitchen equipment needs to be updated, and so that kind of delays our admitting of more folks.
Lee says TCC is awaiting resolution of some billing issues related to the kitchen upgrade. The model TCC is employing with the new apartments is called Housing First, in which tenants get a safe, low-cost place to live, good meals, and access to support programs like job training, but aren't required to stop drinking. The approach has been successful in getting people on the right path in Anchorage, Seattle, and other cities, and Lee says it seems to be working in Fairbanks.
Just in the 3 weeks we've been in operation, we've seen just very good results. Reduction in drinking, taking ownership of the building, and that sort of thing. It's been very heartwarming.
Lee says TCC has received 120 applications for the 47 units, and every applicant qualifies. She says tenants are being selected with the idea of getting people with the most severe problems off the street first. One 100 years ago today, the largest explosive volcanic eruption of the 20th century happened in Alaska. The Katmai Nova Rupta explosion was 30 times bigger than the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980. The explosion happened on the Alaska Peninsula, about 100 miles east of Kodiak City. Ash from the eruption would eventually travel as far as the Mediterranean. So much volcanic material was released that it destroyed everything in the surrounding 40 square miles. The volcano decimated Kodiak's fishing industry, destroyed homes, and killed plants and wildlife. KMXT's Jennifer Canfield compiled this account of the eruption. It includes Kodiak residents reading historical letters about the event and a volcano researcher who has studied the eruption.
I'm Judy Feirstein. I'm a research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. The eruption started at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on June 6, 1912. The eruption lasted for 3 days, and there were three periods of heavy ash fall in Kodiak. The story started when the mail steamer Dora was doing its usual mail run from Uyak to Kodiak. They sailed up the strait on a Thursday on June 6th. The day was nice and clear, so they could see everything that was going on. Just after they turned toward Kodiak, they heard a really big explosion. When they looked back toward the Alaska Peninsula, they saw a big eruption column rising quickly from the direction of Mount Katmai. That's when they saw the big ash cloud, and a few hours later, by 3 or 4 in the afternoon, the ash was getting much closer, and by about 5 o'clock or so, the ash started falling on the deck of the Dora. In the meantime, about 6 o'clock in the evening, the ash started falling at Kodiak. And the people there really didn't know what was happening at first. They could see the big cloud approaching, but they didn't know really what it was or what to expect.
Letter from John Orloff to his wife, Tanya. Kafla Bay, June 9, 1912. My dear wife, Tanya, first of all, I will let you know of our unlucky voyage. I do not know if we'll be alive and well. Every minute we are awaiting death. Of course, don't be alarmed. A hill was erupted near here, so it is covering us with ashes in some places 6 feet and other places 10 feet. All this began on June 6th. Night and day, we light lamps. One cannot see daylight. In a word, it is horrible, and we are awaiting death every minute.
The ash accumulated for many hours, and it didn't let up until the next day. People were complaining of sore eyes, they had breathing problems, the water was undrinkable. The manning, the Coast Guard cutter that was docked at Kodiak at the time, was a big help to the population. And when there was some break in the eruption, people would stumble down to the manning and they were given food and water. But no one really knew what was going on, and they were hoping that it would be over. But actually, there were two more events like that that shed ashfall on people of Kodiak. It wasn't until June 9th in the morning that the day dawned clear and no more ash was falling.
Telegraph to the Alaska Commercial Company, San Francisco, California. William J. Erskine, Seward, Alaska, June 10, 1912. The situation in Kodiak is most serious. An immediate aid must be provided or great suffering will result. Use all influence in Washington. Have Manning ordered to remain at Kodiak indefinitely to continue with relief work. It is impossible to ascertain extent of ruin, but Kodiak and Afognak Island and probably many villages on the mainland are buried in ashes.
The ash fall was heavy. It collapsed roofs. There were avalanches of ash off the hill slopes that destroyed homes. Fires were set on houses by lightning. So the people's lives were pretty devastated by this.
United States President William Howard Taft. Information comes of a reliable character that through the action of a volcano in the neighborhood of Kodiak, Alaska, more than 1,000 people are rendered homeless. And unless aid can be given them, they are likely to suffer severely. I ask an immediate emergency appropriation to be expended by the Revenue Cutter Service under the direction of the Secretary of the Treasury. The danger is said to be in the neighborhood of large salmon canneries, and should the streams of the country be clogged and poisoned, as is likely, by the volcanic explosion, loss of life is certain to ensue unless relief is granted. I recommend that an appropriation of $100,000 be made for this purpose.
Not present in Alaska in 1912 were airplanes. There were no airplanes in 1912 yet. And that's what really made the difference. Because the eruption was so remote, there weren't any people who actually were killed directly from the eruption. However, there's a lot of people who live in Alaska now, and there are millions of dollars of cargo and thousands of passengers that fly over these volcanoes every day. So in Alaska, from these volcanoes out in this area, that's, I think, the biggest danger that people face is ash and aircraft. I think that the state's economy would be brought to a standstill, and the effects would be much more far-reaching than just in Alaska. Consider the recent eruption in Iceland. That was minuscule compared to this one. And it's not just passengers, but also cargo that goes around the world, especially here out of Anchorage.
Judy Feirstein is a geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. The piece also included historical documents read by Kodiak residents. The eruption occurred 100 years ago today. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, co-worker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.